This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Kevin Marsh, Assistant Professor of U.S. History and Environmental History at Idaho State University. Kevin is here to tell us about his book, Drawing Lines in the Forest, Creating Wilderness Areas in the Pacific Northwest, published in 2007 by the University of Washington Press. Welcome.
Thank you, Dan. Good morning.
What led you to write Drawing Lines in the Forest?
Well, a convergence between both personal and professional interests. I had spent 10 years, over the course of 10 years, in the summers working for the Mount Baker Snoqualmie National Forest out of the town of Skykomish, working as a wilderness manager in a variety of jobs there, a variety of responsibilities. So I'd come to know at least modern wilderness management from the Forest Service perspective quite well and came to love it. Those years up there were really treasured. So I had a sense of there was a lot of importance to it, not just to me, but to the hundreds of people that I would see using that area. But then it converged with the professional interests that emerged as some discussions in the field of history, particularly the field of environmental history that I look at, which is a very wide-ranging field dealing with everything from public health and disease to urban planning and sanitation. Wilderness issues have long been very much a mainstay among that discussion of historians. And in the 1990s, there arose a new conversation about wilderness that was quite critical of the idea of wilderness and the movement to create wilderness areas, which is the end result of decades of work by a variety of conservation organizations and individuals. And the criticism was based on wilderness as an outdated ideology, an ideology of a pristine landscape completely separate from humans. And many people, including some people very involved in the conservation community, criticized it, saying, well, that's not where our priorities should lie. Focusing on those areas where we don't live has made our urban areas much worse in the long run, was the gist of some of the criticism. There was other criticism from around the world saying wilderness was a U.S.-imposed idea on a lot of places in the world, and it's been very destructive in an imperialistic sense of forcing people out of their indigenous homelands. That wasn't the wilderness that I knew. None of those things fit into that, whether in the U.S. context or the global context. So I wanted to write more about what seemed to me the actual wilderness that exists in the modern context over the last 50 years, because I thought a lot of that discussion among scholars was focused too much 100 years ago in the 19th century and didn't really relate to what I saw on the ground for 10 years.
What is the definition of wilderness?
I think that's part of the problem where I disagreed with a lot of this international discussion of wilderness is there wasn't a clear definition. To many people, it's just a generic idea of an area where there's not much human influence, a pristine area. And part of the criticism was that there is no such place. People have been living on the planet and shaping it for thousands of years through the history of humanity. But I don't think it's that helpful to think of wilderness in such a vague concept. So in my book, I'm very careful to discuss wilderness is only those places that have been set aside by the United States Congress with that label of wilderness on it. And that comes up to a little over 100 million acres of the American landscape, about 4% or so of the United States has that designation. So to me, that's what wilderness is in a modern context. It's an area where we, through the political structures, have established areas that are protected, and we give them that label. And there are specific legal definitions tied into that.
What purpose does a wilderness designation serve?
I think it often depends on the time and the place. And that is another thing that I emphasize in my book, that we can't understand wilderness just as this generic concept to be applied randomly wherever, that wilderness itself has different meanings based specifically on the time and place, and particularly on the people involved in those particular debates. Because wilderness comes down to definitions over where are we going to draw those boundaries around specific areas. And so that's the focus of my book. And the purpose, through much of my story, being placed in the Northwest, in the Cascades, from the 1950s up to the 1980s, the purpose during those years and in those places was distinctly to divide areas on the national forests, some of which would be open to logging and to road building, which were the dominant activities of the United States Forest Service during these years that I cover, 1950 to 1984. And on the other side of that line would be areas off-limits to logging and road building. I did some oral history interviews and looking through the papers of this from both the perspective of conservationists and environmentalists and the timber industry. It's very much that distinction. It's all about where can we log, particularly the big trees, the lower elevation forests, and where can people not log. And so in that context, that's the distinction. Today, it's somewhat different. Today, the emphasis is on increasing recreational use, and the division tends to be between motorized recreation and non-motorized recreation.
In your book, you speak of a wilderness designation as a form of land use. Would you explain?
Sure. I think that is somewhat of a different concept than usual, and because particularly that ideology of wilderness is that of a pristine area untouched by humans. And so we think of it as a place where it's the antithesis of land use. But I think that's somewhat disingenuous to think about an area like that, because it's pretty clear that humans affect everywhere. That's been our nature, particularly in the industrial era over the last couple centuries. And we can see it today with climate change. We see it today in terms of acid rain or ozone levels in the Alpine Lakes Wilderness, for example, just east of Seattle. They're affected by human use outside the area. And so there's human impact in all these areas. I think that we as a people make decisions about what to do with the environments that we live in. And the more conscious we are of those decisions and the impacts of them, the better prepared we're going to be to make the right decision, whatever right means in that context. And so to think of wilderness as a form of land use, I think, is more honest. It's a way that we are shaping the course of an area and its resources, choosing not to log, not to build roads in an area, not to fight fires in a wilderness area, which is often the choice by land managers, has huge implications for that landscape. We're not leaving it on its own, per se, but we are very much making a decision that has big implications for the future of that area that we're different from if we were to make other decisions.
You've alluded to this already, but who were the key participants in defining wilderness areas in the Northwest, and what were their goals?
Well, somewhat the participation changes a bit over those decades that I write about, and their goals change somewhat. The participants really arise in the 1950s as a group, and you see them in the Seattle area, we see them in the Portland and Eugene area, some of which have been around for a long time. Very active groups in Seattle include the Mountaineers, which are founded at the very first years of the 20th century. Out of Portland is the Mazamas, which were actually founded before the Mountaineers. Both were hiking alpine clubs. And after World War II, they noticed that a lot of the places that they liked to hike and climb were being built over with roads and being cut by the enormous logging boom that started in the late 1940s on the national forest lands. And so that got them involved and concerned. And people in the 1950s in the Seattle area, like Polly Dyer, who's active with the local Sierra Club and the Mountaineers, people like Patrick Goldsworthy, who helped found the North Cascades Conservation Council, along with Polly Dyer and others, were there. Down in Eugene, Carl and Ruth Onthank were essential in the 1954 in their living room, creating a group called the Friends of the Three Sisters Wilderness Area. And those people really got the ball rolling in challenging Forest Service decisions. Now, in the 1950s, when they're gathering in Seattle and Portland and Eugene, elsewhere too, in more rural Washington and Oregon also, they're trying to shape the Forest Service, because the Forest Service is the one that makes decisions on wilderness areas. There had been wilderness areas on Forest Service lands since the 1920s, when Aldo Leopold, a Forest Service employee, was able to convince the agency to create the Gila Wilderness in New Mexico. Is an area off-limits to road building in the 1920s for the automobile boom. So by the 1950s, the Forest Service controls this decision-making process of what is a wilderness area. The Forest Service is making changes in those boundaries in the 1950s, and they're reducing the size of wilderness areas, such as those areas in Oregon around the Three Sisters and up in the Glacier Peak region. It's clear they want to open up more areas to logging, because that is their priority in these years. And so the emphasis or the goal is to try to get the Forest Service to alter their decisions a bit, to change some of the boundaries. The Forest Service refuses time and again And that pushes people for their first goal is to get it out of the hands of the Forest Service. And they're successful in creating the Wilderness Act. In later years, the goal of these groups, and many of the same players, involved to be more proactive in defining the boundaries itself, not just fighting a defensive struggle against a federal bureaucracy, but more proactive in creating a wilderness area, envisioning its boundaries, and presenting it to Congress, who by this time period, after 1964, has the power to create those. The Alpine Lakes Wilderness is an example of that. And so a group of people meet up around Hyas Lake around 1970 to create the Alpine Lakes Protection Society, and a group that's still very active in the Seattle area. And they present to Congress their idea. It's not a Forest Service idea. It's their idea for the Alpine Lakes Wilderness. And that idea, with changes over the years, the wilderness areas created in 1976, becomes the Alpine Lakes Wilderness Area. Over time, there's a much more of a switch toward ecological concerns rather than just recreation that was there strongly in the 1950s, and so there's a bit of a change. And one thing I emphasize in my book is that the timber industry also has played a role in shaping those boundaries quite profoundly, and not a simple role as an opponent, but an active player. For example, today, the Alpine Lakes Wilderness Area, the boundaries were helped shape by Bob Witter of the Weyerhaeuser Corporation, sitting alongside Doug Scott of the Sierra Club, and the two of them hammered out a compromise boundary. Why would Weyerhaeuser want a wilderness area? Well, it established some security in their mind for long-term business prospects, because once there was a line drawn between wilderness and non-wilderness, it created a sense of security among the Northwest timber industry that they could rely outside those boundaries on timber supplies. That vision wouldn't always come to be for them, but that was their hope, so they played a role as well.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Kevin Marsh, Assistant Professor of U.S. History and Environmental History at Idaho State University, and author of the book, Drawing Lines in the Forest, Creating Wilderness Areas in the Pacific Northwest. Would you give just a very brief overview of the case studies you discuss in your book?
Yes, the way I've organized the book is around specific places. As I mentioned earlier, that's one of the things I want to point out, is that I think that a lot of these decisions are shaped by particular places, debates over specific spots, and they could be single stream beds, as in the case of Horse Creek, which is around Chapter 1, which deals with the Three Sisters Wilderness Area and its creation in the 1950s. I move back and forth between Washington and Oregon over the next couple chapters. Chapter 2 deals with the Glacier Peak region and the creation of North Cascades National Park in 1968. Chapter 3 deals with the Mount Jefferson area in Oregon, and it too was created by Congress as a wilderness area in 1968. Then I move back to a chapter devoted to the Alpine Lakes Wilderness Area, which is finally established in 1976. Another chapter deals with the debate over the valley of French Pete Creek in the Western Cascades of Oregon, which by 1978 will be reattached to the Three Sisters Wilderness Area. The Forest Service had removed it in 1957. Here by 1978, Congress reattaches that valley along with some neighboring valleys to the Three Sisters. And the final chapter deals with the 1984 wilderness bills in both Washington and Oregon, which were the last major congressional actions to declare wilderness in both Washington and Oregon. Not the last single time Congress has done that, but the last major effort in both states to do it, particularly on national forest land. And I end with an epilogue that just overlooks at things, some of the trends of the debate since 1984.
What have been the challenges of protecting lowland forests as wilderness as opposed to high alpine and subalpine areas?
That's been the crux of the debate. It's very rare to find opposition to wilderness through these decades, particularly from the timber industry, that says no wilderness at all. There's only one case where I could find that, and that's with the French peat debate. And that's arguably the industry's biggest failure during these years. For most of the time, it was fine, and you see this clearly stated by all sides, is there's no argument over creating wilderness, but there's an argument over the boundaries. And where those boundaries lie, the crux is how far down the valley should they go. And that's where we get into the big trees in the lowland forest. It's important to understand that the lowland forests of the Northwest in the lowest elevations, in the most productive timberlands, are mostly gone by this time period due to early cutting earlier in the 20th century on private lands or suburban and urban growth during that time period. So we're dealing with the public lands, the national forest lands, which tend to be more middle elevation and then the upper elevation alpine areas. And so that's where political opposition arises, when groups seek to preserve forested valleys, not the alpine terrain. There's not much opposition to that. And the opposition can be pretty strong. And this is the major lobbying organizations for the timber industry in the United States get very involved. Their files are just packed full on the Alpine Lakes wilderness because to them it was important as to where those boundaries would end up being placed, down low in the forested areas. They want to make sure that a significant portion of that timber, meaning almost all of it, will be placed outside those boundaries. They also want to make sure that there's no attachments to that law limiting the use of timber outside the boundary in any way, and that was a big concern to them with the Alpine Lakes where that had been proposed. So the challenges are extreme. We see it today in the boundaries. There really aren't that many lowland forests that are protected by wilderness in the Northwest. There are stunning pockets of it, the Alpine Lakes included. A place like Deception Creek, just below Stevens Pass, is an extraordinary place, about 10 miles of classic old-growth forest. But that's the rarity. And it took a lot of negotiating to get Deception Creek in the Alpine Lakes wilderness rather than outside the Alpine Lakes wilderness.
Overall, how well did the conservation community meet their goals during the wilderness debates that you cover in your book?
Well, it's somewhat mixed. I think for the most part, it's extraordinarily well, because there's a group of people who really don't have much background in the political lobbying who gain great strides in this. They really change. In some ways, they've defeated one of the most powerful federal agencies that the United States has ever seen, the United States Forest Service, which would become one of the largest bureaucracies in the American government in terms of employees, certainly in terms of land base that it manages, and also particularly in terms of its sense of pride in its mission and its ability to make decisions for the good of the people, the greatest good, as the Forest Service motto had been since its founding in 1905. And after 1964, and particularly by the 1970s, suddenly the Forest Service doesn't have a role to play. It's being left on the outside by Congress, by environmentalists, and by the timber industry over these debates. And that's a revolutionary change in the way Americans make political decisions, taking it out of the hands of one federal bureaucracy. And I worked for the Forest Service for 10 years. I admire the people in that agency tremendously. But there was a time there when the Forest Service felt itself above politics, above the political interests of individuals, and would make decisions on their behalf. That changed. The Wilderness Act of 1964 took that power out of their hands and gave it into a more broad-based power of Congress, which itself has its problems of decision-making and its limits on political access. But it's much more accessible. It requires public hearings. It requires votes. People who make those decisions in Congress are responsible to come the next election for the decisions they made, and they can be removed on those decisions. And so it opens it up to both sides. And that's where the timber industry gets more involved in the political debates over wilderness as an active player, and that's where groups arise, like the North Cascades Conservation Council, the Alpine Lakes Protection Society, and a variety of other groups in the region getting involved to deal with them with wilderness, and they meet a lot of their goals. There's a lot of land outside those wilderness boundaries that conservationists had wanted to see inside the boundaries. In fact, the acreage of land outside those boundaries that gets cut during these years far surpasses the acreage of land that gets placed within wilderness boundaries. If we measure by acres, the timber industry wins out during these years. But that's not the only issue of the debate. It's not just about acres. It's about setting political precedent as to who has the right to participate in decision-making. And in that way, it is a very impressive political victory by grassroots organizing.
How well did the logging interests meet their goals during the wilderness debates?
Well, if we measure it by acreage, not too bad during these years. Of course, the years I study are 1950 to 1984. In no means is that the only years of wilderness debates. They are carried out well before that time period, and they continue to this very day. But within that time period, I mentioned earlier, the timber industry really wants to create a sense of security for lands on public forests that will be given a priority to timber production. Those lands will be outside the boundaries of wilderness. And to them, it seems to just emphasize that priority. And there's a hope of that to create stability in the industry. In that hope, they failed. And I don't think they thought this was the sole key to finding industry stability. Finding stability in the timber industry had been a challenge since the earliest days of the timber industry in Washington and Oregon. It's really rarely been there. It's one of the big issues why the Forest Service was created in 1905, was to help create that stability for big companies. And it certainly wasn't there then. Hope was they would find it with these wilderness debates, finally resolve the situation about these roadless lands. That also would not come to fruition for them, because economic and market forces would have more of an impact than anything else over those areas. By the early 1980s, the market for the timber had just fallen apart. It was a struggle to make ends meet. A lot of mills shut down at that time. And then the issues over spotted owl and limits over logging through the 1990s and additional market forces that just lowered the price too far below where it was profitable to cut a lot of this timber, it devastated the industry again. And that all had to do with lands outside of wilderness boundaries, not inside wilderness boundaries. Wilderness itself certainly didn't hurt the timber industry, but it didn't help them to the degree they were hoping it would.
What are the implications of the struggles to define wilderness areas in the Northwest for the rest of the country?
I did try to write this book to be more than just of interest to the Northwest reader. I think that's particularly where people find familiarity with it, because it's people and places that will be recognized by a reader in Oregon and Washington. But I also tried to write it to a national audience, partially as to that discussion of wilderness as a vague idealistic concept that has been criticized, and saying, well, you know, wilderness is very concrete. And wilderness, as it's debated, is relevant to particular places. And specific people have different interests over the wilderness concept and wilderness as a law. And so the main lesson to the rest of the country is that all land conservation really is inherently local. If we want to study some of the implications of this, we shouldn't be looking to broad ideals and visions that emerged out of artists of the 19th century, which is where many people root the 19th century, the wilderness ideal itself. They should be looking at individual people who have gotten involved in the political process since World War II, when, at least since 1964, that political process is open to everybody, and people are walking through that door. And so to understand it, I think, seriously, we need to look at the local context. William Cronin, who was one of the people involved in that 1990s wilderness debate and critiquing wilderness very severely, with articles in the New York Times and such, he wrote a foreword to this book. And one thing that he thought stood out is that there's a recognition there that all land conservation is inherently local. And the way he put it is that God and the devil are always in the details.
In what ways did the land use disputes in the Cascades affect the efforts to pass the 1964 Wilderness Act?
I think that's one thing that hasn't been emphasized enough in the past, and that is one of the early points I try to make in the book, is that these aren't just local concerns to the Northwest, but they have national implications, particularly early on, and especially in the Three Sisters wilderness debates in Oregon in the 1950s, and also in the Glacier Peak region, beginning in the later 1950s and up through the 1960s. I mentioned earlier that conservationists in the region would try to influence the Forest Service to make its internal administrative decisions over where to draw boundaries over a place like the Glacier Peak Wilderness Area, which is established in 1961 by the Forest Service, previously called a limited area. And that boundary really was a high alpine area with a couple different valleys, but it's not the boundary of Glacier Peak Wilderness Area today. And for the Three Sisters, what the Forest Service did was remove 53,000 acres from the previous Three Sisters primitive area, which was created in the 1930s by Bob Marshall and others, a famous name in Forest Service and wilderness history, and just removed it on its own. Despite the hearings, like several days of public hearings, the Forest Service saw no reason, had no obligation to change its decision, and it did not. So that angered people nationwide. It became a sense that here's an agency that feels it's above the public interest of what's being expressed by local people of conservationists. And so the national effort came to focus on passing a law in Congress, which took that power out of the hands of the Forest Service. And that's what the Wilderness Act of 1964 does. And so I think that the disputes in the Cascades, I think foremost the Three Sisters wilderness area, Howard Zahnizer, will be the main author of the Wilderness Act. He's there at those hearings. And he writes in years later that was a turning point in getting the Wilderness Bill passed, was the Forest Service's lack of listening in that case and just making its own decision. To a lesser extent, the Glacier Peak region as well, where the Forest Service is making the same sort of unilateral decision-making on what will happen. It doesn't necessarily lead to the Wilderness Act in that case, but what it leads to is removal of land itself from the Forest Service and the creation of the North Cascades National Park, which is very clearly a punishment to the Forest Service as an agency for making decisions on its own and not listening either to individuals or to members of Congress who become quite angry about Forest Service intransigence. And arrogance is a term that they use a lot. And that leads mainly to the Wilderness Act of 1964. It also leads to the creation of the North Cascades National Park.
How do you see efforts to create wilderness shaping up in the future?
It's an interesting future because it's changed a lot from this area that I write about. The main issue in the 50s through the 80s is over timber, trying to draw lines where the expansive timber economy will not reach, and areas preserved away from the development of roads and industrial logging operations. That's the crux of that debate. Today, that's not so much the issue over wilderness. Today, throughout the Northwest, and Idaho included, where I live these days and see it, it's more the division today is between different types of recreation. There's been an explosion over the last 15 to 20 years in the use of off-road vehicles, motorized recreation. Some of these areas are getting into or pushing the boundaries of existing wilderness areas. Some of these users are getting on trails that traditionally have been non-motorized. And so again, there's a sense of a threat, certainly on both sides. And both sides tend to be coming to the table now to create wilderness areas that represent a division between motorized and non-motorized recreation. Another element that's come into play with wilderness areas today is perhaps they can be used to satisfy other goals, which certainly is not new. But the other goals today would be dealing with endangered species habitat, and particularly in the Northwest with salmon habitat. So now when you see wilderness proposals, some of them are very low elevation. The Wild Sky Wilderness, which has been passed by the House of Representatives in Congress this year, is one which includes and is justified, at least politically, by its contribution to improving salmon habitat. And so we have different justifications and different players coming to the table these days than we did in previous years.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I think that the message or a lesson from this is that these decisions matter, that wilderness is not just an arbitrary concept that we might debate around a cup of coffee or something. The wilderness is a real place, or they are real places, and they're places that affect us, that not everybody gets into them as often as others do, but they're parts of the public land. And that's an essential part of what is wilderness. You had asked earlier, it's all public land. It's inherently public, so it's owned by the American people and managed by the United States government. And it's a lesson of political participation, of civic responsibility, I think, that stands out in these years, is that people got involved, and they got involved in very large numbers. In terms of the debates over wilderness and roadless lands in general in the National Forest, no issue in American history has drawn more public input than those issues. In terms of petitions and letters to Congress, nothing has drawn more interest and more numbers of people writing to legislators than has the issue over roadless lands. And I think the message is that these are our decisions to make. They are not easy decisions to make, especially when you open it up to the democratic process. It's very difficult. That's part of the frustration of roadless and wilderness issues. All caught up in the courts. There's the sense of gridlock that is frustrating to people on all sides. But the previous model was a very small group of people within the United States Forest Service and the Department of Agriculture of the United States government that oversaw the Forest Service to make those decisions. I think the main lesson here, it's worth getting involved, whichever side it is. That's one reason I emphasize in my book that the timber industry was involved, very actively involved in some very creative ways, and they actually set the tone for getting public participation in, getting their workers to write letters, sign postcards, well before the environmental community took those same tactics to heart and used them in more recent years. And so whatever side it is that people are involved, they have an interest here. And I think it's a good lesson in the value of civic engagement.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Kevin.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
We have just been speaking with Kevin Marsh, Assistant Professor of U.S. History and Environmental History at Idaho State University, and author of the book, Drawing Lines in the Forest, Creating Wilderness Areas in the Pacific Northwest, published in 2007 by the University of Washington Press. Kevin will discuss Drawing Lines in the Forest at the Ballard Branch of the Seattle Public Library Thursday, July 26th at 6 p.m., and also will present at the University Bookstore on Monday, July 30th at 7 p.m. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week.